Graduating from college, hurtling toward adulthood is scary in the best of times. And these times are, well, turbulent. I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. This week is our graduation special, and we are going back to basics. This show is full of real life advice on the simple things. Get a good job, build good credit, save for a house. Let's just focus on the stuff you can control. Remember, you can always come talk to me or the team. Email us, we're weekend@marketplace.org, or on Twitter, we're at @MarketplaceWKND. So yes, like I said, there is a lot going on in the news right now, but it is also graduation season, and we don't want to leave those grads behind. We're going to spend this hour on life after college, or what we are calling graduating into the economy. The class of 2017 is firmly in the millennial camp, and millennials are the largest generation in the United States. So what is that generation worried about when it comes to building a financial future after all those years in school? A couple of recent college grads from California share their thoughts.
My name is Michelle Salinas. I'm 24 years old, and I graduated from UCLA last June. I'm a first-generation college graduate, daughter of working-class immigrants. I've been on the job hunt for almost a year now. But there's a huge disconnect between college and getting a job. We don't learn how useless submitting applications online can be without a direct reference. We doubt ourselves and our capabilities, and that's amplified if you're a woman, a person of color, working class, etc.
Hello, my name is Gina Agbanyi. I'm 28 years old and a graduate from Loyola Marymount University with my master's in counseling. For our program, we have to complete 600 hours of an internship, and it's a little difficult to work full time during that process. So I decided to not work and supplement, well, fulfill my income with loans. And that is something that I am fearful about, trying to be hopeful to think that education debt is good debt, but it's still debt in the long run.
A little bit of insight there into some of the issues bothering recent graduates. No surprise, getting a job is a biggie. So let's start there. First, the good news. Salaries for graduates are at an all-time high, averaging around $49,000 a year. That's according to numbers from Korn Ferry. But as usual, there is also bad news. A recent Fed survey suggests that a college degree doesn't guarantee a career. Just 45% of millennials said they got hired in their fields, and we haven't even made it to student debt yet. So how do you break through all this noise to get the gig you want? We brought in Allison Green, founder of the popular job site Ask a Manager, to offer some advice. Allison, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Molly.
So we had this sort of somewhat basic question from a listener, which was, do millennials switch jobs more frequently? There's certainly the impression that they do.
There is the impression that they do. I do think there's some truth to it. And part of it is that they haven't had the same sort of loyalty from employers that used to be more typical. And they are painfully aware that they are not likely to get the same kind of commitment from a company that their parents might have had. And so they might not be as inclined to show it themselves in return. But, you know, I think there's another side of this that you don't hear as much about, which is that a lot of millennials would really like to have stable employment where they can settle in for a while. But they graduated, a lot of them graduated into such a tough economy that they've had trouble finding that. So you see more switching jobs as they try to move onto the path that they want to be on. But I think for a lot of people, it's less about a preference to jump around and more about what they've had to do to survive in an economy that's been hard to be a young worker in.
Wow, that's interesting. Do you think that the parents have learned some of the same lessons about companies, or that even if older people are switching jobs, it's sort of the same dynamic?
I think I hear from a lot of readers who get job advice from parents and other older relatives that to them doesn't seem to reflect the reality that they know. I hear a lot about parents who are kind of panicky that their kid is switching job after a couple of years, and they worry about what that's going to do to their career history. And the kid is like, look, all of my friends do this. This is really typical in my industry. I think it varies, but I do think there's a real phenomena of parents whose job searching advice reflects another time.
Yeah. How, if you are stringing jobs together, is there a way that you can brand yourself that will help you establish a career?
Yeah, first and foremost, if you can avoid jumping around a lot, it is a good thing to avoid. Not everyone has the luxury of avoiding it. I wouldn't jump just to find something new after a year or two. You can do that a few times, but if you keep doing it, it's going to limit your options. But if you've found yourself in that position through no fault of your own, or maybe it has been your fault, but you want to figure out what to do about it now, I think you want to look at what the common strands have been in the work that you've been doing. I mean, one advantage to staying at a job for, say, 5 years is that usually you're able to show some progression in terms of responsibilities and autonomy and authority. So I'd look at your career through that lens. Is there a way to show it with the multiple jobs that you've had?
So let's say you are job hopping and job hunting. Let's go back to basics. What makes your resume or your cover letter stand out to a hiring manager?
The thing that I see most people not doing as well as they could be is not just talking about the assignments that they've been given or the things they've been responsible for, but what they actually achieved, what outcomes resulted from their work. I mean, you want your resume to be different than the resume that a coworker who did kind of a mediocre job would have. You want yours to reflect something different. Because hiring managers don't just want to know what your job description was, which is what a lot of resumes show. They want to know what kind of employee you were. What did you get done? What changed as a result of it being you in that job versus someone else?
And then how do you hold your own during an interview process? I mean, it seems like interviews these days last 4 days and have a bunch of homework.
Yeah.
How do you kind of stand up for yourself?
I think most importantly, you really want to be prepared. You want to spend time before your interview really reflecting on what it takes to do the job well and what evidence you can point to that you would excel at it. Too often, people don't spend the time getting clear on that themselves. And if you don't, you can't really expect your interviewer to get a clear picture of it either. So you want to walk into the interview ready to share examples of times when you have successfully used the skills that the job requires. And I think, too, you want to think about what you need to know from the interviewer to figure out if it's a job that you want and would do well at. And people tend to really neglect this part of it, especially newer grads, but it's really crucial to ask your own questions and think rigorously about the answers to make sure that you end up in a job that you're good at and that you can be happy in.
What about negotiating? I know that's everyone's favorite topic, but if you don't, say, get the salary you want, can you actually negotiate things like benefits?
Yeah, sometimes you can. It's often easier to do it in smaller companies where things aren't quite as standardized. But really, in any type of company, the easiest benefit to negotiate will almost always be vacation time. And especially if you're coming from a company where you had pretty generous vacation time, you can explain that you don't want to lose that, and you can ask the new company to match it. There's often more flexibility there than people realize. And particularly if a company really wants you, they're going to look for ways to make it work. I will say for millennials, new grads will generally have less negotiating power. You know, when you're pretty new to working, you're more likely to have to take the standard benefits package. But it's good to know that as you become more in demand, it is something that you can negotiate.
What's the most surprising advice that you find that you still have to give?
The thing that I find myself saying probably more than anything else is to just talk like a normal person. If there's something that is upsetting you or something that you want or something you wish was happening differently, so often, and I especially see this with younger workers, but it's true in all age groups, so often people sort of suffer in silence and they get frustrated or resentful or just unhappy. Speaking up doesn't always fix it, but very often, if you just have a conversation, I mean, whether it's my coworker is singing loudly all the time and it's driving me crazy, or I want a raise, or I was hired to work on X, but all of my time is being spent on Y, whatever it might be, having a conversation will almost always get you at least closer to the outcome you want than saying nothing at all.
Allison Green runs the site Ask a Manager. Allison, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
And starting next month, Allison Green will be joining us regularly to answer our questions about jobs and work issues. Email your queries to weekend@marketplace.org. Love to do the numbers here at Marketplace. It is, you've probably noticed, kind of our signature thing. So I'm going to hand things off to a couple of Marketplace's resident millennials, the just barely 24-year-old Sarah Menendez. Happy birthday, Sarah. And Tony Wagner. And they're going to bring us some of this week's news by the numbers. Take it away, Tony.
Thanks, Molly. Our first number is...
$2.4
million. That's how many dollars the owner of the David and Gladys Wright House paid for the property back in 2012.
The Arizona home was designed by famed architect Frank Lloyd Wright, who would have been 150 years old on June 8th.
Wright designed over 1,000 buildings and homes during his career, including New York's Guggenheim Museum.
The owner of the Arizona House is gifting the property to the School of Architecture at Taliesin, where it will be a place for students to practice restoration.
23.
That's the percent coach airfare has decreased compared to last summer, according to Kayak.
That may have something to do with the increase in foreign budget carriers flying to the U.S.
Low fares make it easier to get out of town. A flight to Europe could run you as low as $200 one way.
The fares might be low, but unless you're a master packer, expect to shell out for bag fees.
24.
That's the number of movies Sony is releasing in its new clean version mode.
Right now, the list includes 50 First Dates, Easy A, Moneyball, Step Brothers, and more.
The studio has come under fire for its decision to edit the so-called clean versions.
Sony is hardly the first company to create sanitized versions of films, but they are the first to offer them directly to consumers.
Great, now I can get my toned-down Adam Sandler directly from the gosh darn source.
Hi, everybody. It's Kai Rizdahl. Marketplace is here because these days it's essential to have an independent source explaining how the economy really works, not just for CEOs, but for everybody. Your support keeps this kind of reporting coming, and it's especially vital now at the end of our fiscal year. So please visit marketplace.org/donate to contribute and to keep us in your world every day. And thanks.
We are continuing our look at life after college and the economic realities ahead of new grads. There are three basic pillars of building a financial future: find the right job, stack some cash, and build your credit score. But here's the thing. Many in the class of 2017 grew up in the shadow of the Great Recession. Lots of them have student loans averaging $37,000 in 2016. And it's easy to understand why recent college grads might shy away from debt of any kind. So let's face the fear head on. Brian Kelly is the founder of ThePointsGuy.com, a site devoted to helping people build credit while having some fun at the same time. He has mastered the credit game, and he has some advice for new grads who are just getting started.
So the first thing I would do is check your credit score. You can do it for free at annualcreditreport.com, as well as there's a number of credit cards, if you already have one, that will let you check your FICO score. And your FICO score is the key score you want to understand, because that's what most credit card companies will use to judge your credit worthiness. FICO is very transparent with how they calculate a score. So the biggest part is 35% of your score is payment history. So even if you don't pay your bills off in full every month, making sure you at least make the minimum payment is 35% of your score. After that, it's 30% of amounts owed. So, you know, paying off your bills in full every month is the quickest way to increase your score. And then 15% is the length of credit history. This is where college grads may, you know, fall a little bit. And then there's 10% credit mix. So not just having credit cards, but also auto loans and store credit accounts, and then 10% is new credit. So there's no one factor that will destroy your credit score, so to speak, but you know, being strong in all those areas is what makes someone credit worthy.
Even if you don't have a credit card yet, you might have a credit history from student loans. So once you've checked your score, it's time to figure out what kind of card you might want to get.
Millennials want experiences. So millennials don't want fancy watches. They want to travel. They want to go and explore Southeast Asia, and they don't have huge salaries. Points can provide experiences that you otherwise can't afford. You want to start your relationship off with the credit card companies that have the best product. So even if you can't qualify for one of the premium cards right now, Chase, American Express, and Citi, and Capital One are kind of the big dogs in the rewards game. So with Chase, you don't want to go for the Sapphire Reserve, which is a Visa Infinite product. So that's actually the highest amount of credit needed to get. You want to start with just a regular Visa product like their Freedom Card, no annual fee, and they have rotating categories, or the Freedom Unlimited. So those cards are generally easier to get. You don't need to have a huge, you know, credit history and salary to get a beginner card like that. The no annual fee cards are definitely a good starting point, but the biggest mistake I see people make is looking at, oh, well, this card has no annual fee, it's the best. Actually, the cards with like $95 annual fees, like the Sapphire Preferred, they waive the fee the first year, plus have huge bonuses, like 50,000 points, which is worth, you know, conservatively $625 if not more, if you know how to transfer the points. So I would say don't just go for a no annual fee because you're going to save money in the short term. Think of the big picture. And also think about the areas where you spend the most in your day-to-day life and try to get a card that gives you bonuses on those categories.
Not into points and miles? Okay. If you're just looking to save money, there's a card for that too.
Even if you don't want to travel, I'd recommend still getting a cash back card because cash is king. So Citi has a no annual fee double cash card, which essentially gives 2% back when you pay your bill off in full, which is the most rich cash back no annual fee card, in my opinion. You know, definitely getting a cash back card. It'll help you build credit and put more money in your pocket.
In fact, apparently there's a card for everything. But how about that rumor out there that millennials don't like credit cards?
Millennials definitely like credit cards. That's our number one audience on our site, but they want cards that give them value. So they are definitely skeptical and want value, but that's why so many college grads and millennials do have points earning credit cards. So I would recommend, you know, if you are skeptical, that's good. You should be. You know, the credit card companies in history had deceptive practices, but as long as you understand credit and you're not going to bury yourself in debt, then getting a credit card makes complete sense.
And there you have it. You can find more advice on building your credit on our website. Go to marketplace.org. And plenty of you reached out with thoughts and questions for us. Haley Townsend graduated from Kenyon College in Ohio last year. On the jobs front, she says her friends fall into two categories of disenchanted workers. The ones who are passionate about what they do but get paid very little, and the ones who have a great paying job but sort of hate it. She asked, why is it so difficult for millennials to strike the right balance between a job that matters to them and a job that lets them support themselves? We also heard from Kevin Longa, an independent documentary filmmaker in California. He asked about profitable business models for content creators now that there's so much available online for $0. And we also got this voice memo.
Hi, my name is Intisar Siraj. I'm 25 years old and I graduated from the University of Southern California. As a recent graduate, even though I have prior work experience, it's tough finding a job right now. I think people want you to know someone. They want you to start off as an intern, which is very frustrating. I graduated with my master's degree. Another thing that I think about when I think about building my financial future, actually living in a city that is affordable because I want to be able to save money while I make money and be able to travel and whatnot.
And we got a lot of advice from you on Facebook and Twitter. Stuff like, live like you're still a student. Save, 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 says Nancy Matthews from Greenwich, Connecticut. Vakrit Adelai from Atlanta, Georgia said, start saving early. Compound interest is a beautiful thing. I will just add that unless it's on your credit card debt. And Linda Chenoweth Harlow in Dallastown, Pennsylvania, suggests young grads take advantage of a 401k if their jobs offer it. Put in as much as you can afford, she says. Roll it over into another account if you leave and resist the urge to dip into it. Do you agree? Disagree? Let us know your thoughts on jobs, housing, and saving for the millennial generation, especially if you belong to it. Email us at weekend@marketplace.org. Follow us on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. And of course, we have the newsletter. Subscribe at marketplace.org. More than 90% of millennials say they eventually want to buy a house. That's according to the National Association of Home Builders. So how are you supposed to prepare for such a huge expense? Buy less avocado toast? I know you saw that one coming. But it turns out millennials are not really a bunch of crazy spenders, according to the data. Not any more than baby boomers, anyway. And the challenges of buying a home are real, sometimes due to completely external factors, like the rise in home prices, the reality of student loans, and slow wage growth. We heard from some listeners about how they're coping with the housing question.
Hi, I'm Jason Wang, and I live in New Hampshire. Basically, I don't have any interest in buying a house at this time. I'm happily renting and paying down my massive student loans. Even if I didn't have the student loans, buying seems like a bad move because it ties me to one job market, and that's not something I want to do early in my career.
Others have found novel solutions for finding a home that's at least semi-permanent.
My name is Bella Fishbane. I am 32 years old, and my partner and I live in the Bay Area.
So when we were looking into our housing options in the Bay Area and what we could afford, we could only afford a small apartment or maybe a starter home. And we wanted something better. So we decided to invest quite a bit into our tiny house because we felt comfortable with the idea and we knew we wanted our dream home. And the only downside was that it would be tiny.
And Bella's home is on wheels. Regardless of what you may choose, all these options require savvy money management. So what can young grads start doing now to save money for their dream homes? We brought in Delia Fernandez, a personal financial planner with 23 years in the business. Delia, thanks for joining us.
Hi.
So it seems like, contrary to what we may have heard, millennials are getting this done, this whole house buying thing.
They really are.
Let's talk about how they're doing it. If you are a young grad, how do you prepare yourself financially to get a house?
You have to figure out where you are financially. You have to figure out what you can afford, and you have to figure out if you've got room in your budget to save, because the biggest issue in buying a house, next to being able to afford the payments, is having the down payment. So you need to put aside some money for that purpose.
And how do you figure that out? I mean, it's you know, it sounds easy to say, but I think that's the daunting part, right?
It is the daunting part, but all of us have to learn these money skills. So I think the important thing is to look at your paycheck every month and take a look at yourself the way a lender would. How much income do you gross every month before they start taking out taxes? How much do you already commit to debt? Maybe you have student loans or a car loan. And how much do you have, do you think, of your budget that you could allocate to housing?
What about if you live in New York or Los Angeles or Washington, D.C. or the Bay Area where I live, where it just feels like it's never going to happen no matter how much you save? Is there still hope?
There is still hope.
Even in these markets.
You might have to make some tough decisions, and you might have to see if you're lucky enough to be able to go to the bank of mom and dad. That might be a part of your plan. Listen, we like to live where the action is, but to afford the house that's within our price range, we may have to face a commute. And that's reality in the big cities. Absolutely reality. Or we may make the trade-off and say we're going to buy a place in the city and we're going to have five roommates the rest of our life. Make the decision.
Right. So let's talk about renting, because that is also a bigger and bigger trend. Is there any kind of benefit to renting for a few years so that you can save for a home, or even just sort of staying flexible so that if your city gets unaffordable, you can scamper off to somewhere cheaper?
Well, Molly, that's exactly it. So that's an essential time in your life when you're either in the type of industry where you need to move from market to market, like, say, the media industry or the high-tech industry, or whether you just want to be flexible and take advantage of whatever might come up, because a lot of time our careers take us in different directions. So renting is okay, but remember that you're going to have enough room in your budget to have extra cash on hand to take advantage of those opportunities, first and last on the next place that you move to, for example. So don't rent and spend every dime that you make on renting and entertainment, because you're going to need some savings for that next opportunity.
I'm happy you said renting is okay, because I think that is another central question that millennials and even new grads are asking, which is, do I have to buy a house? That's been conventional wisdom for so long. There's a real sort of lifestyle conversation to be had, right?
Absolutely. Here's the key. I just want to make sure that we can accomplish everything that you want to accomplish and not have the rent get so expensive going up every year that you can't afford to live your life. So you always have to be calibrating that. But I don't think rent is inherently evil. As you know, in some of these big cities, they raise the rent every year, and you have to have an income that keeps up with that. Or you have to have room for another roommate, right, to help pay the rent. And that's a reality of renting. So I don't think renting is evil, but that means you just have to keep an eye on your budget even more closely to make sure that the landlord doesn't raise the rent too much so that you can still afford to stay where you are.
So student debt, let's talk about that, because that is obviously looming, especially for these new college grads.
Absolutely.
Is this question of how they're going to manage that debt and save for not even maybe a home, but just emergencies?
Lenders are going to be okay with you having student debt. You have to decide if it's student debt you can afford. So here's a rule of thumb. If people are still in college, let's try not to take out a total amount of loans that are more than what you'll earn the first year out of school. So if you're a liberal arts major and you think you're going to make $30,000 that first year, maybe you shouldn't take out a total amount of loans more than $30,000. If you're an engineer, maybe that's more like $60,000 or $100,000. Just depends.
I love that. That's really good.
Isn't that interesting?
And yeah, I wish I had known that.
Yeah, exactly. And make sure that you lay out, here's the other problem I see with student loans is people graduate, but they really don't know what they owe, and they don't know what the terms of the loans are. That is, they don't know what the payments are or the interest rates or how long they last.
So work itself is changing, and the way that people work is changing. There's a lot more, you know, people don't have as many, or lots of young people don't have regular, permanent, full-time jobs. They might be in a creative field, they might be part of the gig economy, they might be sort of cobbling things together. Does that have an impact, or are all the rules still the same?
No, it has a huge impact. So you always have to be ready, you have to be flexible, and you have to have an emergency fund on hand. You've got to have 2 to 3 months of bare expenses set aside somewhere, ultimately, in case somebody does it to you, in case they lay you off.
So Delia, on this question of gig economy workers or freelancers, people who are a little more flexible, what kind of issues does that raise? How did they prepare themselves for a potentially skeptical lender who says you don't have a guaranteed income every month?
Yeah, you don't have a guaranteed income, but you have a history. So what anyone who's self-employed is going to face is they are going to face a lender who wants documentation of your income. They're going to look back the last 2 or 3 years of tax returns. They're going to want to see your checking account to see that money is being deposited. You have to be able to show that you can steadily support yourself.
Delia Fernandez is a personal financial planner and investment advisor in Southern California. Delia, thank you so much.
I've enjoyed this.
And you can find more advice from Delia Fernandez on our website, marketplace.org. As we were working on the show here at Marketplace, we started talking with our coworkers about what they wish they had known when they graduated college. After all, this is a shop where we talk business, finance, and the economy all the time. So here are a few thoughts from the lovely folks at Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. It's Kai. Here's my 20 seconds on what to think about as you graduate. It's okay not to have a plan. It's okay not to have a plan. I was 34 years old before I figured out I wanted to do radio. I had two careers before that, and I had no plan. It's okay not to have a plan.
Hi, I'm David Brancaccio, host of the Marketplace Morning Report. I wish, upon my graduation, someone had looked me in the eye and said this. The secrets to success are show up to work on time, shower occasionally, and learn Mandarin.
Hey, this is Andy Euler. I am a reporter at Marketplace. One thing I wish I would have known when I graduated is to not be suckered into 0% APR when you're signing up for a credit card. You'll end up paying for it in the long run if you don't just pay those credit cards off immediately.
Hey, this is Marketplace reporter Jed Kim. My advice is you're going to be applying for a lot of jobs that you really want, getting rejected. I'd say every now and then, apply for one you really don't want. Because there's nothing more cathartic than writing a cover letter you just don't care about.
Hi, it's Lizzie O'Leary. I wish someone had told me that I was going to screw up and that it's okay. Because making a mistake, owning it, and learning from it is one of the most valuable things that you can do.
Wise words from Lizzie there, and a thought of my own. Sometimes you don't always get taught how to deal with money early on. In fact, for some of you, maybe this show is the Cliff's Notes you wish you had gotten before you graduated. But you know what? Even if you don't know, it's okay. Don't take it personally. Don't get emotional. It's just money. It is a skill like any other, and you can do this. Adulting isn't that hard. Well, most of the time. We are going to step back from the ways that graduates should be managing their careers and their credit cards and turn to how they're spending the money they're making. The National Retail Federation estimates that retail industry sales will grow 3-4% this year, and that includes online sales. If there is anything we know for sure about millennials, it's that they're all about the digital experience. And one online company that seems to encompass all of the millennial stereotypes is Everlane.
Welcome to Everlane. You're standing in the entryway to our office.
They are known for their minimalist style, and they are all over Instagram and Facebook. We sent two of our producers to check out their San Francisco headquarters.
Hi, I'm Eliza Mills.
I'm Haley Hirschman, and we're going to be telling you about Everlane. That's the sound of T-shirts being made at Everlane's factory in Los Angeles, California, and it's playing in the bathroom at Everlane's headquarters in San Francisco's Mission District.
It's all part of the experience of Everlane and its brand. You can see it in the rest of the office. Airy open spaces, lots of trendy houseplants, white walls, blonde woods. Everything is ready to be put on Instagram.
That includes the company's staff, dressed head to toe in the muted grays, olives, and navy blues you see in Everlane's clothing.
Whenever someone was wearing the same thing, we would take photos of them and call it like Everlane twins. It happens more often than not.
That's Alyssa Bergerson, the communications lead at Everlane. And the Everlane twin thing is intentional. It's almost made to feel like a makeshift uniform, and not just for Everlane employees.
We make clothes so that you can focus on doing great work and you don't have to like worry too much about like what you look like or anything like that.
Red Gaskell runs social media at Everlane. Fashion is all about copycats. With no copyrights on designs, it's really easy for popular styles to make their way from high-end brands down to fast fashion stores.
Everlane's biggest competition is from middle-tier retail brands like J.Crew's sister company Madewell and the Japanese shop Uniqlo. And even though the brand may feel exclusive, the minimalist style it's curating is everywhere, and it's a mainstay on social media. That's important, says Kurt Cascino. He runs the millennial marketing agency Hype Life Brands.
Things like Instagram have so much power because millennials also speak in pictures more than they do words. That's a really powerful way for retail brands to really reach millennials, is to speak in the way that they speak.
What millennials care about is crucial to Everlane's success. Over 30% of its customers are between 18 and 35. 95% have some college education.
Of course, not everyone fits into the Everlane market. There are plenty of people who are unwilling or unable to pay a premium for transparency, especially for clothes billed as basics. But as millennials get older and their wallets get a little thicker, pleasing this customer base will be even more important. Here's Kurt Cascino again.
Within the millennial generation is over $200 billion in buying power. The future of retail and any real B2C brand really relies on the millennial generation.
Millennials are notably brand loyal, but what keeps them coming back is frequently more about ethics than product. Everlane's business model is built on what they call radical transparency. They disclose information on the factories that make their clothes and the price of labor and materials that go into each product.
Retail journalist Elizabeth Holmes likens it to other ethical consumer movements.
It's like with the farm to table movement. You know, people want to know where their food came from. People want to know where their clothes came from.
Everlane is hoping that transparent pricing is the next organic kale.
But blank slate basics and even transparent pricing are easy to mimic. And if other brands copy Everlane's model, it could present a challenge. For now, what has put Everlane ahead is the brand evangelism it inspires. We met Yana Ivanov, a 20-year-old customer at the company's flagship brick-and-mortar shop. Here's why she buys Everlane.
I was like really in search of like a sustainable clothing company for like a long time. And every time I found one, it was like ridiculously hippie. And I'm just like, this is cool, but like, I don't want to look like that. And so it's cool to see them have like modern styles.
If Everlane is betting right, it's possible to make a business of blending in and letting its personality shine through.
That's Alexandra Spunt's job. She's Everlane's creative head. She focuses on storytelling, mostly visuals. But because this is for the radio, we asked her to describe the company as if it were a sound.
I sleep with a fan, and I just love that, like, it can move in and out of your awareness. Like, sometimes you don't even know it's there, and then in other moments you're like, oh, I love that sound, and you feel the wind on your face. And so it'll be something maybe subtle like that.
If Everlane's pared-down aesthetic is the fan and its transparent pricing is the breeze on customers' faces, maybe it can be the white noise millennial fashion needs to get through another night.
That was Marketplace Weekend's Eliza Mills along with Haley Hirschman. And you can take our fun little quiz online. Is it Everlane or is it a scene from Nancy Meyers, The Intern? You'll find that at marketplace.org. We'll be right back. Now from trendy clothes to the trendy backdrops for the photos you are posting of yourself in those trendy clothes on social. And the latest required backdrop decoration is plants. Instagram is super green these days. Accounts devoted to houseplants and gardening have hundreds of thousands of followers. And one company is cashing in on the hipness of houseplants among young gardeners. The Sill started life as a local business in New York City and now ships nationwide. Let's hear more about it.
Hi, my name is Eliza Blank, and I am the founder and CEO of The Sill. The reason why I started The Sill was really to fill a void in my own life. So I had moved to New York City from Northampton, Massachusetts, which is a very green town. I moved to New York to attend NYU, and as an 18-year-old, was really struck by the lack of greenery in New York. I felt like there was a real void in my life. And in fact, I grew up with a lot of houseplants at home. My mother is from the Philippines. And so she grew up climbing mango trees in her backyard. And when she moved to the States, she made it a point not only to be an avid gardener, but to fill my childhood home with houseplants. I knew entering into this business that it was a sizable market. So we know Americans are spending billions of dollars on houseplants, pots, and accessories each year, but they just weren't able to do so in a way that mimicked their day-to-day life now. So the garden center industry really hasn't changed in the eyes of the consumer for nearly 100 years. I went into this knowing that this was a business. It wasn't going to just be a hobby. It wasn't going to just be solving my own problem. I saw this as a problem that many Americans face that I wanted to tackle. Today for us, because of the way that we've built the brand, we really found our niche to be with millennials. So about 44% of our customers are ages 25 to 34, which is really great because we know that the fastest growing segment of gardeners happens to be millennials. And we know that we can speak to them in their language because nobody else is. And that's a real advantage to us. Millennials are the ones who are, you know, they're moving to the cities, they're living in apartments or smaller homes. Plants offer a really low-cost way to decorate or maybe to spruce up your home or maybe to change things up a little bit. And we're certainly seeing a ton of inspiration on social media, whether it's Pinterest or Instagram. Millennials love to share, and I think that's also been a compelling piece of our business is that we sell plants and plants are beautiful and everybody wants to share pictures of their plants. It's that combination of offering, you know, the right sized plant, the right priced plant, the right types of plants that are kind of on trend, and to an audience who otherwise spends nearly 90% of their life indoors and the majority of their day in front of a screen. Okay, I'm taking you to my favorite plant. Right now, we're standing in front of our shelves in the store, which we have mounted pretty high up. And the reason is that we sell a lot of plants that trail. So one of my all-time favorite plants is the philodendron. What I love about it is it produces these beautiful green heart-shaped leaves, and it grows really quickly. It was always an inspiration for me for the business because, of course, we want to grow the business quickly. And it's also an incredibly resilient plant. You pretty much can't kill it. It will suffer tremendously and it still won't die. So I love that idea of always growing and really being able to sort of visually see that for yourself.
If you need some help figuring out what plants work with your lifestyle, you'll find suggestions on our website, marketplace.org. It is time now for the Marketplace Quiz. That's when we ask people in the spotlight questions about work and money, and they tell us about the lessons they learned along the way. Producer Haley Hirschman has this week's guest. She was Lizzie's favorite character on Freaks and Geeks. I loved her as Hawkeye's wife in Avengers, Age of Ultron. Basically, she's done a little of everything.
Hi, I'm Linda Cardellini, and I'm an actress.
Fill in the blank. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you...
big parties.
Do you throw a lot of big parties?
I have before. I have a giant family, so I like to throw big parties.
what is the hardest part about your job that no one knows?
Finding new ways to field any kind of rejection. I think you have to constantly be evolving your defenses without putting up a wall and still being vulnerable. I think that is it's sort of an evolving skill because, you know, not everybody's going to love everything that you do. So you have to sort of forge ahead and at the same time let it roll off of you while still being vulnerable. That's a balancing act that I'm always trying to understand.
What was it like when you were first starting out as an actress?
It was hard, but I was resilient because I was determined that I would do it. And there's this part of you that, you know, I say like you have a little bit of a screw loose in order to believe that you can fight against all those odds and do something that is, you know, relatively to me, it seemed impossible. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, I thought somehow it would be possible. And you sort of start to, you concentrate on the positive things that happen and you try to eliminate the negative ones as you go along, but that's not always easy.
What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying?
Oh, wow. That's a big, long list. Well, right now, I have a 10-foot table in my front room that is taking up the majority of my front room. My friend's aunt was, they were getting rid of a lot of her things, and I thought, well, that's a beautiful table. Let's take that home. And it's actually just served to collect 10 feet worth of things that we should actually be putting away.
What is your most prized possession?
I have about 8 place settings of this Depression-era milk glass that my grandmother collected going to the movie theater back in the day. And back in the day, when, as an incentive to get people to come out, they would give them gifts because, you know, so many companies were going under during that time. And so in the 20s and 30s, they gave away this milk glass as you went to the movie theater. So I have 8 place settings that my grandmother collected going to the movie theater as a kid in San Francisco. To me, that's one of my most special things that I have because it reminds me of my grandmother and it also reminds me of her sort of struggling coming up and collecting. My grandmother kept everything perfectly.
Is there any advice that you wish that you had received when you graduated college, whether it be about work or life, that you think these 2017 graduates should hear?
You know, the world's really wide open. And whatever it is you studied or whatever it is that you are passionate about, if it's not what you studied, that's okay. But find what it is that you love, because life is too short, and do what you love and do it passionately if you can. And that will take you further spiritually than anything.
Linda Cardellini stars in the 3rd season of Netflix's Bloodline, which is out now. We thought it would only be appropriate to end our graduation special with a commencement address. Heather Haberleski writes the Ask Polly advice column for New York Magazine. She's also taken the Marketplace quiz, which you can find online. But without further pomp or circumstance, here is the 2017 Marketplace Weekend commencement address.
On your graduation day, everyone tells you that the future is wide open and the best part of your life is just beginning. Everyone urges you to believe in your passions and throw yourself into your bright, shining future. What people don't talk about is fear. They don't acknowledge the unbelievable fear that haunts you every minute of every day. It's like you're being pushed out of a plane without a parachute as someone yells after you, "Follow your dreams! Embrace the adventure!" But it's totally normal to be afraid, because for the past 4 years, you've been living in the middle of a park where people read great books and drink beer all day long, and now you're being kicked out of paradise. You've got to pay your rent and your bills and your student loans and your health insurance, God only knows how, and you're probably going to have to take some entry-level job where you report to a middle-aged guy who uses words like impactful and scalable best practices and core competencies without even cracking a smile. But you've also got to decide what to do with the rest of your life, which is like falling out of a plane and trying to solve a Rubik's Cube before you hit the ground. The fear can be overwhelming. And what your fear tells you is that only losers feel fear.
Your fear interrupts that middle-aged guy talking about core competencies and whispers in your ear, "You have no core competencies. You can't follow your dreams because you have no dreams. You can't have adventures because you're too afraid to have adventures or to do anything at all." But your fear is wrong. Everyone is afraid. You'd have to be a robot not to be afraid right now. And sometimes successful people are the most fearful people of all, but they use their fears to fuel them. That's what you have to do. Admit that you're afraid. Face your fear. That doesn't mean battle it. That means keep it close, like a potted plant in that dumpy new apartment you can barely afford. It will always be there, so you might as well make a little room for it. Making room for your fear instead of hiding it makes room for other things too. Sadness and dread and angst and longing, but also hope. Because even though the world is scary, all human beings feel afraid, and we work hard to believe in ourselves and to believe in the world in spite of our fear. Don't pretend that you're fearless, because if you pretend, you'll never know what your passions are. You have to feel fear to feel your passion. And it's not an adventure if you can't feel the fear. Adventures are partially made up of fear. Fear provides the suspense. You're still going to have to work hard. You won't be going back to paradise. But when people treat you like you're small and foolish just because you're afraid, that means that they're still running from their own fear. So just ignore them. I hate to say this, but it's true. Some robots will want you to feel small because they can't feel anything at all. But you're not small. You know that. You contain multitudes, especially when you're afraid. And when you look back on this time years from now, you'll almost miss the fear a little bit. You'll look back and say, "I had it all, but I didn't even know it. I was so afraid, but I was at the center. I could breathe in happiness. I could swim to the moon. I had everything I needed."
Heather Haberleski's book, How to Be a Person in the World, will be out in paperback on June 27th. You can find details on all of our Life After College advice. Go to marketplace.org. And if you still have questions or stories, we still want to hear them. Email us. We're weekend@marketplace.org. And that is it for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Haley Hirschman, Eliza Mills, and Paulina Velasco. Joanne Griffith is our senior producer, and Chris Clark is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our general manager. I am Molly Wood. Lizzie O'Leary will be back next week. Thanks for listening. This is APM.